This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting Aspen Public Radio in Colorado. Ambassador Wendy Sherman was the chief U.S. negotiator on the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. She also visited North Korea twice during President Bill Clinton's administration and met for hours with Kim Jong-il, the current ruler's father. Ambassador Sherman joins us here in Aspen to discuss America's approach to authoritarian leaders and other foreign policy challenges facing the Trump administration. Ambassador Wendy Sherman, welcome to 1A.
Great to be with you, Joshua.
Glad to have you with us. But I definitely want to talk to you about North Korea and Iran. But we should probably start with Syria because it's been in the news this week. On Monday, the White House said that Syria's President Bashar al-Assad seemed to be preparing another chemical attack. President Trump warned that Mr. Assad would, in his words, pay a heavy price if one took place. First of all, what do you make of the president's statement? And then let's talk about what you think some of the possible courses of action could be if indeed Bashar al-Assad is doing this. But first of all, what about the president's statement on Syria?
Well, it's actually quite an extraordinary statement in the sense that it was apparent at the time he made it that the Pentagon had no heads up about it. The State Department appeared to not be engaged with it. I'm not sure where this came from and what the basis is. One assumes the White House would not issue a statement unless they had some intelligence that showed that Assad was in fact doing this. I always think it's good if you see something to say something because it can act as a deterrent from Assad taking such action. That said, I'm quite concerned that there isn't a strategy here, that the president is approaching Syria tactically. Quite frankly, Syria is an international failure. We have all failed the Syrian people in terms of solving their problems, ending the civil war, getting rid of terrorism, getting rid of Bashar Assad, who is a dictator who has used chemical weapons, barrel bombs against his own people.
Syria, you're right. Syria is one of those international quagmires that I think a lot of countries would say that they bear a piece of the blame for. Walk us through how this could have worked. If you could go back and address the Syrian situation differently, where do you think we could have done better? What else do you think could have been done to prevent Syria from turning into the mess that it's in today?
Well, it's been very difficult because it is a proxy war. It's not just about the Syrian people. It's not just about Assad. It's not just about ISIL. But there have been opposition groups financed by various factions in the Gulf, and certainly by Iran and Russia's participation, which has increased over time. So it truly is more than a quagmire. It's a disaster zone. Clearly, President Obama took very tough decisions early on about whether and when he was going to arm opposition leaders. Personally, I wish he had done that earlier. I understood why he wanted to go to Congress to get support for a strike against Syria after the first chemical weapons attack. Congress didn't show up for that. We probably should have known that because at the time, Prime Minister Cameron in Great Britain had tried to get the parliament to support his efforts in this regard. They hadn't shown up for it either. That's why I say this is really everybody's failure. And the people who have really borne the brunt of this are the Syrian people. There are over 12 million people who are refugees, internally displaced people. Syria has really been taken apart.
I heard you mention the military aspect of all this, which I think a lot of the president's critics kind of used as critique against him, the so-called red line that he said could not be crossed and then got crossed. President Trump ordered Tomahawk missiles to be fired at a Syrian airbase in retaliation for reports that President Assad used chemical weapons back in April. Now there's this talk of Syria possibly preparing another chemical attack. Does that mean that nothing's working?
Well, you know, that Tomahawk attack was something that I supported. I think most people did. But you cannot take an attack like that in a vacuum. You have to have an overall strategy. And it's not clear to me beyond that tactical move what our Syria strategy is, what the president intends to do. And if, in fact, there is another attack, besides another quite frankly, that was pretty much a pinprick attack. It didn't destroy that base. It didn't destroy that airfield. They began using it again, I think, within 48 hours of the strike. So what are we doing? Yes, we are fighting ISIL in Syria, as we should and as we must, and we're doing that in part because Iraq wants us to protect their border from ISIL coming back into Iraq. But what are we doing both diplomatically to try to see if there's a way forward that is not about war? And what are we doing as a long-term strategy to end this fierce battle inside the country?
And just by way of the geography, for those of you who are not deeply following the Syria situation or for whom maybe this is a little confusing, Syria and Iraq share an east-west border. If you hold up your left hand and face the palm, your pinky is the border between Syria and Iraq. That's basically the geography we're talking about. I imagine that the situation in Syria for you as an ambassador has got to be so frustrating to watch, especially because it seems like a situation where diplomacy is just dead, where at least for the U.S.'s part, the solution, it seems like the military solution may or may not be the best option, but it's all we got right now.
It is extraordinarily difficult. I was engaged when I was the Undersecretary for Political Affairs in some of the negotiations with Lakhdar Brahimi, who was a UN envoy trying to solve Syria. And so he, a Russian delegation, a U.S. delegation, which I led, tried to sit down and build on a Geneva agreement that had been reached when Secretary Clinton was Secretary of State. And that was to try to create a political transition, a peaceful political transition, in Syria to a new government, and really for Assad to find a way to step aside. That's gone nowhere. There is a new UN envoy. He's really been dogged in trying to find a diplomatic way forward. But so far, we've all come up empty.
We're speaking to Ambassador Wendy Sherman, currently senior counselor at the Albright Stonebridge Group, former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs at the State Department, and chief negotiator for the U.S.-Iran nuclear agreement in 2015. We welcome your questions and thoughts for Ambassador Sherman, not only about Syria, but North Korea or Iran or any of the hotspots that the U.S. is trying to figure out a way forward with. Email us 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Let's talk about North Korea. Last week, you wrote an op-ed in U.S. News and World Report arguing that the Trump administration and other countries should be putting a lot more pressure on North Korea. What do you think that pressure should look like?
Well, I think what we need to do is comprehensively use every single tool in the toolbox that we have all at once. Prior administrations have tried one thing or another, but not really arraying everything simultaneously. So I think we need to ratchet up sanctions against North Korea. Sanctions won't stop their nuclear program. The use of sanctions is really to try to focus their minds about the choices that they are making. We need to really be going all around the world to enforce those sanctions, cut off their financial lifelines, their ability to get technology into the country. We need to array our military and continue our exercises with South Korea and Japan, look at missile defense, military deterrence. We need to use our intelligence and cyber capabilities however we can do so appropriately. We need to use public diplomacy, and we need to use diplomacy. Keep a channel open if North Korea gets serious about negotiations. Now, President Obama is about to welcome President Moon Jae-in, the new president of South
Korea. President Trump, you
mean? President Trump, sorry. President Trump is about to welcome President Moon Jae-in from South Korea. President Moon has wanted to find a diplomatic way forward to engage with North Korea, even suggested for the next Olympics that North and South have one delegation, which the North said, no, thank you.
Right.
So I think that, and we should keep a diplomatic channel open, but I don't think that it's yet ready for prime time. Until North Korea is forced to make a choice, not believing, as it currently does, that nuclear weapons are the only way to protect their regime, but rather they've got to make a choice between regime survival and nuclear weapons.
This seems like such a pernicious problem, North Korea in particular, because you've got two major players that are very important to the U.S., China and South Korea, butting up literally against the problem. I mean, you mentioned President Moon. They have obviously a very strong concern about the demilitarized zone. They're like 30 kilometers away from where these missiles might be. The president also has tweeted about China's potential role in all this. Earlier this month, the president tweeted, quote, "While I greatly appreciate the efforts of President Xi, the president of China, and China to help with North Korea, it has not worked out. At least I know China tried." How much, from a diplomatic perspective, do you think the U.S. can delegate this to China and North Korea? Does this really have to be the U.S. leading the way? Or are there certain things that China and South Korea can do that we just can't?
Well, there are absolutely things they can do that we just can't, but we shouldn't delegate away our national security interest. We have to stay very engaged in this problem. And you make an excellent point, which I meant to mention earlier. Critical to this comprehensive strategy is, of course, China using the leverage that it has. In the Iran deal, the United States had an enormous amount of economic leverage, but China is really the key here. They've got some legitimate concerns. We need to address all of those concerns, maybe not perfectly, but without addressing them, China's not going to use the leverage it has to get North Korea to the table in a serious way.
Quite a bit of economic leverage, particularly since China's basically North Korea's trading partner.
Absolutely. It's its lifeline.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot more internationally that we would love to talk to you about on the other side of this brief pause as we continue our conversation with Ambassador Wendy Sherman. Plenty to talk about regarding Iran. I'd love to reflect on that. On the state of U.S. diplomacy, the Department of State under the current Secretary Rex Tillerson, and more with Ambassador Wendy Sherman. Later in the hour, we will be speaking to novelist John Grisham about his new book, Camino Island, and we welcome your questions and thoughts for the ambassador or for Mr. Grisham, 1A@WAMU.org. I'm Joshua Johnson in Aspen, Colorado. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing U.S. foreign policy and national security challenges with Ambassador Wendy Sherman. She was the chief U.S. negotiator on the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and now senior counselor at the Albright Stonebridge Group. We welcome your questions and thoughts about America's toughest geopolitical and diplomatic challenges today. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Let's go back to North Korea for a second. You met the late Kim Jong-il, the current ruler's father, for hours on two separate visits to North Korea during President Bill Clinton's administration. What did you learn about North Korea from former President Kim that you think could inform the way forward for the U.S.? Is there something about the way that North Korea operates that maybe the U.S. needs to keep in mind, or maybe that the average American might not realize?
Well, I think most people look at the current leader, Kim Jong-un, Kim Jong-il's son, and think he's just a crazy guy. And so how can we possibly deal with him? His father was not crazy in the way that you think of somebody who's completely out of control. He had complete control of his country. He was very transactional. He could have a perfectly straightforward conversation. They live in a paradigm that's not ours, but it's one that makes sense to them. And that paradigm is the United States is a threat to our regime. It can destroy us. So we must have nuclear weapons to ensure the security and the survival of our regime. And we must do whatever we need to accomplish that. We need to keep China as our lifeline because we can't make enough food. And we are going to put nuclear weapons and military first ahead of everything else. It doesn't make sense to us, but from where they sit and what they're trying to do, really to continue this dynasty of dictators, it makes perfect sense. We were trying at the end of the Clinton administration to negotiate an end of testing of missiles, because at that time there was an agreement that had kept their nuclear program in check for some time, and they had no nuclear weapons at that time. We didn't want them to develop missiles because then they would have a delivery system for the nuclear weapons. That's what we're very concerned about now, an intercontinental ballistic missile that could bring their nuclear weapons to the United States. So I think that we need to go at this in a very clear-minded way, a very comprehensive way, a very disciplined way. And my concern is that although President Trump has conducted a North Korea policy review, I've seen no evidence that there is any policy. And the one other thing I think it's really important to mention is this has gone to a whole new place because of the death of Otto Warmbier.
Yeah.
There is just no way to give comfort to Otto's family. What a despicable, horrific death to get your son back just as he dies.
Yeah, certainly Otto Warmbier, the young man who just recently came back home after more than a year in captivity in North Korea, came home in a coma and died soon thereafter, changes the whole game, no question. President Trump has said he would be willing to meet with Kim Jong-un if the conditions were right. You have said that Kim Jong-il viewed the U.S. as an existential threat to North Korea, and so we got to have nukes to fend off the U.S. I wonder what the path forward might look like under the Trump administration. President Trump has said his foreign policy is America first. I could envision, and we don't have any evidence for this, I'm just kind of like brainstorming, I could envision a deal whereby, for example, North Korea is allowed to develop a small nuclear arsenal for the sake of calming it down. And then once they have the nuclear arsenal, if we convince the North Koreans, hey, we're America first, we don't care what you do over here, just don't bother us, game over, everybody wins. Could that be a solution?
I don't think it's a solution. And the reason is if they have a nuclear arsenal, it's going to, which they already do, it's going to concern South Korea and Japan mightily, and they might consider getting their own nuclear arsenal. There's a proliferation issue here of other countries deciding that they need to do this too to thwart any American action. So I don't think allowing North Korea to have a nuclear arsenal and just leaving them alone is the answer here. I think one of the things that's sort of strange is President Trump had President Xi of China to Mar-a-Lago and thought he had come to some agreement with him. Everybody I know who went to China subsequently, the Chinese didn't think they had any agreement. And now we've seen this tweet that you mentioned where the president said, I know China tried, but they failed. There have been news reports that now the president's given up on China. Well, you can't give up that fast. You've got to spend some time and really put in the time. We've just gotten an ambassador to China. We don't have senior leadership at the State Department because Secretary Tillerson doesn't want anyone until he can do a reorganization. It's really a crazy way to go about this, quite frankly. And so there isn't a team in place to help the president implement any strategy he might come up with.
Let's get to a few questions from some of our listeners. One listener wrote on our website, the1a.org, is there any sign that Russia is preparing their rail line to North Korea and any close ports for possible increased trade? How is that Russia-North Korea rail link currently used?
Yeah, that rail link has been a subject of quite a bit of conversation for a long time. And Russia is a player in the negotiations with North Korea. And North Korea's development of nuclear weapons, in fact, involved Russian engineers many years ago. So we want to take care of that. In fact, Kim Jong-il, the father of the current leader, took that rail line to Russia for a visit. Kim Jong-un, the current leader, hasn't gone anywhere, has never left his country.
And this is a rail line that runs from Russia through China into North
Korea.
Because Russia and North Korea don't share a border.
So I think that we need to be talking to Russia about this as well, and we need to make sure that Russia doesn't see an alliance here with China and North Korea against the United States.
Joshua tweeted, instead of saber-rattling, can't the North Korean banks be cut off from obtaining convertible currencies? Explain that.
Absolutely. What I'd said earlier is we really need to send teams around the world to get countries to cut off the financial links that North Korea has for hard currency to finance their nuclear weapons program. So the listener is exactly correct.
Let's shift gears to Iran. You are the chief negotiator for the U.S. on that deal. Remind us briefly what the deal involves.
So what the deal involves is it allows Iran to have a small enrichment program, creating the fissile material that is needed for nuclear power and could be used for nuclear weapons, except constraints have been put on their program so they cannot enrich that material to the point where it could be used in nuclear weapons. And in return, there is tremendous verification and monitoring of Iran's civil nuclear program. The United States and European Union, the international community, has lifted the nuclear-related sanctions on Iran in return. Now, there are still sanctions on Iran for their terrorism, their human rights violations, their proliferation of weapons. Mm-hmm. So there's still a lot of pressure on Iran, but Iran now will not be able to obtain a nuclear weapon, and that's quite critical.
Now, the administration says that Tehran is complying with the deal and reining in its nuclear program. At the same time, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said the deal was under review. Many conservatives have consistently denounced the deal as President Trump called it the worst deal ever. Do you think that, do they have any point? I mean, is this a bad deal for the U.S., even in terms of, for example, letting Iran create any kind of nuclear material, especially if they proved not to be trustworthy?
So I understand the concern, and President Obama thought very carefully about this. We do have the capacity to bomb all their facilities. President Obama even commissioned and deployed a weapon that could penetrate the once underground facility called Fordo, which was an enrichment facility. But you can't bomb away knowledge. The Iranians know how to do what they know how to do. So if you bomb away their facilities, they could recreate them probably within 2 years, and they would likely do it underground and in secret. So military action is an option. It remains an option even today, but it won't end their nuclear program. We could continue to use sanctions, but sanctions never stopped their nuclear program. When the Europeans began negotiating before the United States joined in the early 2000s, Iran had 164 centrifuges. Those are part of what you need to create this fissile material. By the time we were negotiating, even with the extraordinary sanctions we had on, and effective sanctions we had on Iran, they had 19,000 centrifuges. So sanctions aren't going to stop their program. It's just meant to focus their mind and their choice, which it indeed did. So I think this deal is a very good one to protect the United States, to protect the world, and to ensure that Iran can't get a nuclear weapon.
Plenty of foreign policy questions from our listeners, including some critiques of our strategy on Iran under the Obama administration. Chip on Facebook writes, please ask the undersecretary about the cash payment to Iran. How did she justify this?
Well, there isn't actually a cash payment to Iran. I think the listener may be talking about Iran's frozen assets in banks around the world. We and our partners in the negotiation, because this negotiation was not just with the U.S., it was with all the five permanent members of the Security Council, Russia, China, Great Britain, France, plus Germany and the European Union. So we were all negotiating with Iran. We had caused through our sanctions for all of Iran's assets to be frozen in foreign bank accounts. This deal allows them to be unfrozen. So this isn't U.S. taxpayer money or anybody's taxpayer money. This is Iran's own money. That is about $50 billion that's available to them. And they are likely to leave a lot of that abroad. So there isn't any outright cash payment in this deal.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Mark emailed, I'm curious how your guest views the current state of things in the Middle East as different from the proxy wars we instigated and participated in during the Cold War era, and why we expect different results when doing the same thing.
Well, I think if the listener is talking about the proxy war in Syria, I'm quite concerned about it, as I said earlier. We also have currently going on a rift between Qatar and Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and others, about who is financing whom to do what. This rift is of great concern because it could lead to conflict. This is a lot focused on Iran and its nefarious malicious behavior in the Middle East, which should stop. And we should be doing everything we can to pressure Iran to indeed stop that behavior.
By the way, thanks to those of you who apparently have a better map than I do. I mentioned that the rail line North Korea.
Yes, but it does have a border with
southwest of Vladivostok in Russia. So
indeed.
Thank you for that. This is how you know that people are actually listening, because they're paying attention. They are fact-checking alongside. So I appreciate that.
And in fact, the last missile launch headed to Vladivostok, and it should make Russia quite concerned.
Kenneth on Facebook writes, I am a Foreign Service officer. I'm concerned that the president does not understand the value and expertise of our professional Foreign Service and that the 30% cut in state budgets is evidence of this. Actually, I think it's more in the order of 37%?
31%.
31%.
31%. I quite agree with the listener. The Secretary Tillerson has decided there will be no A-100 classes for the next 2 years. A-100 classes are new Foreign Service officers that are coming in. So there will be nobody coming in. And a lot of the senior Foreign Service has left because there hasn't been a way forward in terms of appointments and senior people being assigned. So I quite agree that Secretary Tillerson has not shown a great regard and respect for the Foreign Service, which we all rely on.
It seems like the administration has made it very clear that a more broad-shouldered, aggressive foreign policy is where the nation needs to go. Sebastian Gorka, one of the president's advisors, has talked about, you know, the alpha males being in charge now. Explain to the president's supporters why this is not a good time for a more muscular foreign policy. These are dangerous times we live in. Isn't now the time for America to kind of throw its weight around a little bit more with some of the threats that we face?
Well, this is a time when we have to use all the tools we have, not just the military ones. A credible threat of military force is always a very important element of successful diplomacy. So all of these things have to work together. And one of the great concerns all of us on the outside have is what is the policy process for this administration? How are decisions made? When the White House announced their concern about the Syria chemical weapons strike, another one happening, it seemed that nobody in the government knew that, including the Pentagon, who would have to take that strike. So there is great concern about the policy process, the decision-making process, and how we're going about in this very tough world, as you describe quite accurately, Joshua, using all of our tools in a thoughtful way that doesn't accelerate the risk to us and to our allies and partners.
Before we run out of time to chat with you, I would like to know a little bit more about your background. As I understand it, diplomacy was not your first career. You started off in social work.
Right, though I think diplomacy is part of everything in our lives. I have a master's degree in social work as a community organizer. Started in child welfare, went into politics, and ended up in national security and foreign policy. So I tell young people, I wish you an unexpected life. I've been very lucky. I don't believe in five-year plans. I think you miss the best opportunities in life if you don't have an open mind. Urge people to get a really good skill set. I did. The clinical skills I got as a social worker have been, I joke, very useful with dictators and members of Congress.
Exactly.
I think I've continued to be an organizer. The caseload has just changed.
You also worked in politics. You got involved in politics after meeting Barbara Mikulski, became her chief of staff, and later managed her campaign to the Senate. I imagine from what you're saying, that background in social work and politics helped to make you a better diplomat.
Absolutely. I think that diplomacy uses everything that you have, yourself. You have to see the entire landscape. You have to be able to form a group, a team, try to achieve a core objective. And I think those skills have really worked well. I think it's really important in everything I've done. It's never been only about me. The team matters enormously. When people think about the Iran deal, they think about President Obama, who was quite courageous, Secretary Kerry, who was extraordinary, Secretary Ernie Moniz, our Secretary of Energy, who was critical to success, maybe me a little bit. But quite frankly, I had a core team of experts who were extraordinary and literally hundreds of people in the U.S. government who helped to get this done.
And briefly, before we run out of time, what do you think America's foreign policy goal should be right now, our diplomatic goal around the world? If you could sum it up, what the mission should look like, briefly.
I think the mission is always about what is in America's national security interests, but that doesn't mean that we don't understand, accept that other people have interests and try to make the world a more peaceful place so that we can have economic security, which is what people want in their day-to-day lives.
That's Ambassador Wendy Sherman, chief negotiator for the U.S.-Iran nuclear agreement, now senior counselor at the Albright Stonebridge Group. Ambassador Sherman, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, Joshua.
Time to catch our breath. When we come back, we will shift gears and speak to novelist John Grisham about his latest novel, Camino Island. And if you're expecting another legal thriller, well, you'll get one, but it's not really about a lawyer. It's about a writer. A writer writing about writers? John Grisham did it for his 30th novel. That's ahead. Stay close.